This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
I'm not going to say what kind of bar this is. Maybe I will. We're sampling a bar. What do you call it? I mean, how would you describe the bar? It's category.
Pemmican?
No. I mean, it's like in the category of energy bars or what?
Yeah.
Granola bars?
Yeah, like super protein. And
when we were little kids, it was granola bars. But then people started putting other stuff in them. These here, the number one ingredient is ground beef. Then dried prunes, almonds, sweet potatoes, oats, brown flaxseed, tomato paste, on, anchovies. Yanni thinks it tastes like dog food.
He's a big.
There's a hint of dog.
It's got a dog food hint.
Essence.
When I was first sent these, I opened one up and ate it. And I had a box of boxes. I opened one, ate it. It was so bad, I gave the people at the post office two boxes. I'm like, I don't know what you guys all do for lunch, but here. And then I went in there later, and they're like, man, those things were awful. But now they're kind of growing on me. What I did is I put a bunch in my glove box of the car. My kids won't go near them. But when I meant to like be like, I'll just feed them to the kids, and they start complaining in the car. And then now and then I'll be like just out of, like, you know, driving along, and I'll just kind of have a hankering. And they're kind of a little bit growing on me.
These things expired last June. 2015 June.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Better with age.
You're going to want to take a look at that.
My friend met a guy and he described him as, my buddy met a guy and his buddy described the guy as being the kind of guy that grows off of you, which I always liked. But like you like him at first and slowly stop liking him. But these are the kind of things that grow on you. First thing I want to talk about, Yanni, explain this. What we did.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So
did they send you your hat?
Yeah, hell yeah. So we were hunting squirrels in Kentucky, and we filled out a form, a squirrel hunting cooperator survey report. And you like log your squirrel hunting activities. And we sent our squirrel hunting thing in. They sent me a sweet blaze orange squirrel hunting baseball hat. And then they sent a summation of squirrel hunting in Kentucky. So, dudes last year hunting in Kentucky would see 2.5 squirrels per hour in August, which slowly dropped to, okay, in August, a dude in Kentucky, your average Kentucky squirrel hunter, who's probably your better squirrel hunters, because those are the kind of guys that would turn a log in. I don't think I'm going out. You're a trained biologist.
Right.
Would you agree that more tuned in dudes are going to turn in a voluntary log? Or would you think that even shitty bad hunters are going to turn in a voluntary log?
No, I think the guys that are experiencing some success. And also who's hunting in August. Probably people are pretty serious about turkey or about
so this is
squirrels,
not,
right?
So this is probably like a tuned in hunt. So this,
yeah, these are the guys that are dialed in.
It's biased toward tuned in.
Probably.
So in August, your average Kentuckian is seeing 2.5 squirrels per hour and killing about one per hour. By February, here's the weird thing. By February, he's seeing about one squirrel per hour and killing 0.5 per hour. You know what the moral of that story is, Giannis?
Hunt in August?
Yep. They're seeing a lot more foxes than grays.
Ooh. That's good.
When I was opening my mail, I ripped this thing. I'm not used to like regular old mail anymore. I ripped my thing all to pieces. Anyhow, we're going to talk about caribou. Lan Tawney sitting in with us. Lan from BHA.
Howdy.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Ryan Callahan, general guy. Hunter Fisher works at the hunting apparel company First Light. Giannis Patelis, the man who will not make me my perch flies. We work closely together, talk every day on the phone. Still won't do it. And then introduce yourself, Bart.
Bart George.
Bart George.
Yep. I'm a BHA board member for Washington State and a wildlife biologist for the Kalispell tribe up in Northeast Washington.
Okay. Explain that to me. They have a wildlife biologist.
Right. Well, we have a big natural resource department. So we have about 15 fish biologists. I'm the only wildlife biologist, but we
why
have
so many fish and not, and so you work for the tribe,
right?
Because they're just fisheries reliant.
Not necessarily fisheries reliant, but fish where the money's at, right?
Is that right?
Yeah,
I didn't know that
for sure.
And where do you do? Where are you? Where do you do your? Where are you based out of?
Northeast Washington, up Pend'Oreille County. It's the most northeast corner of the state, and then also over into North Idaho, up around Priest Lake, mostly.
But explain that. Why is it that the money's in the fish? Because I wouldn't necessarily guess that.
Well, certainly in the Northwest with all the salmon runs and our the anadromous fish, but then also in our area, it's the adfluvial fish, the bull trout, stuff like that.
Okay, explain anadromous, catadromous, and effluvial.
Well, most of us are familiar with salmon making their run out to the ocean and coming back into freshwater to spawn in their natal streams. That'd be an anadromous fish. Adfluvial fish, like a bull trout that we have in Northeast Washington, they're also an endangered run of fish, but they use big lakes basically as their ocean. So instead of making it all the way out to saltwater, they use Lake Pend'Oreille or one of the big lakes there.
And so anadromous refers to saltwater. Like in the Great Lakes, the salmon, they took Pacific salmon and cut them and established them and cut them loose in the Great Lakes. So they treat the Lake Michigan, for instance, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, they treat it as their ocean, mm-hmm. which is freshwater still, and they run up to spawn. You would say that those are adfluvial fish.
Well, I guess. Maybe I'm talking out of turn, though. I'm a caribou bear. Yeah,
I don't mean to point you into an area you're not familiar with, but that's what's going on there.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so a catadromous fish would be like the American eel, lives in the river, goes out to the ocean to spawn. I think we covered this before.
We certainly might have. I can't say it's been on a podcast.
Yeah, so like an eel spends his life in the river, goes out, actually goes down to the Sargasso Sea. So if you're standing in like New York and you see an eel swim by that, he's going to wind up going to the Sargasso Sea to reproduce. Okay, that has nothing to do with what you work on.
Nothing.
But when you say them, so you... Explain again where you work.
So Northeast Washington in the Selkirk Mountains,
okay.
Into British Columbia some, into North Idaho a lot.
Across a variety of land ownership, like a variety of land ownership areas, or no?
For sure. A lot of state land, a lot of federal land, mostly Forest Service. We don't have a lot of BLM or any other management. A lot of private timber company, Idaho state land, Washington state land, provincial land in British Columbia.
So what's your, like, I don't understand, what's your mandate? Like, if you work for, a tribal organization.
Right. So the tribe, we're a small reservation. We only have about 5,000 acres on the reservation. So caribou are never going to be on the reservation, but they're an important species to the tribe historically. They're in the neighborhood, I guess, 20 miles up the hill.
Okay.
So the tribe, we don't have land ownership responsibility, but we have some management responsibility through cooperative agreements.
I got you. And then lay out for me how you became to be a biologist real quick. Like what sort of education path does a fellow take? When we were kids, we all would say we're going to be wildlife biologists.
Right.
Two of my brothers did it.
Really?
But we just said it because it seemed like a way you get to spend a lot of time outdoors.
It is. It's a good job that way. So I got a bachelor's degree I grew up in Iowa, small mm-hmm. town. Kind of farm kid, went to Simpson College, got my bachelor's degree there, and moved west immediately after college, moved to Washington State and started working on hydropower projects along the Columbia River, and then eventually moved up into Northeast Washington with the tribe. Again, the rivers in the Northwest are definitely where the jobs are at.
Gotcha.
Everything's sort of tied to wildlife mitigation or restoration projects that way.
My brother, who is a fisheries guy, when he first came out west, it was hydroelectric stuff on the Columbia, counting salmon.
Yeah, that's pretty common.
Sturgeon issues. Yeah. Then went on to do all kinds of things he didn't know about at the time.
Right.
When you were growing up in Iowa, there's no way you knew that there were caribou in the lower 48, right?
No way. You probably walk around the neighborhood. I bet most people in Seattle wouldn't know there's caribou.
I lived in Montana for years, western Montana, for years before I had the opportunity to call bullshit on someone who's saying that caribou used to come down into Idaho and Washington. I'm like, no, they did not. You idiot.
They definitely did. They still do.
People, how is it not known?
Growing up in Montana, it was like this Montana history fact. Like, yeah, caribou in Montana.
Yeah.
That's the only way I knew. In Idaho, now that I live in Idaho, I think we need to like reiterate this. Eastern Washington, Idaho, Montana, caribou do exist there. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. And the wolf thing is so giant. And nobody knows about caribou. It just drives me crazy. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's true. It drives everybody crazy.
This year, I'm going to ask you a handful of questions just to get people into what we're doing here to know what's going on. 100 years ago. No, let's do this. At the Pleistocene-Holocene transition, 10,000 years ago, pre-human contact, how many caribou were running around possibly in what is now the lower 48? What was it like 100 years ago? What's it like right now?
I don't know anything about the Pleistocene era or anything like that during, whatever, pre-contact. 100 years ago, there were hundreds of caribou south of the border. There were enough that Teddy Roosevelt went on a guided hunt out of Priest Lake.
Did he get one?
No, but he spent 10 days hiking around the Selkirk Mountains looking for him. So there must have been a handful around to make him think that he could experience some success.
And what was their range 100 years ago?
There are reports all the way down to the St. Joe. In the Coeur d'Alene, but mostly in the South Selkirks and over into the Cabinet Yak area.
And were these caribou 100 years ago just spending some of their time in the lower 48, or was there caribou that would be born and die and live their whole lives in Washington, Idaho?
They definitely live their lives. There's enough habitat up there to support a herd of caribou for sure throughout the year, throughout their life. Right now, there's still caribou that kind of flirt with the border of both the states and Canada, and they kind of bounce around all three areas.
So right now, at this moment, is there a caribou in the lower 48?
We don't know. I guess we only have two callers out right now, but it's possible. I bet there's a caribou within 10 miles of the border, if there's not.
And what kind of caribou are we talking about?
A mountain caribou.
Do you believe in all the distinctions they draw of caribou? Because you know how you have in taxonomy, you have your lumpers and your splitters.
Sure.
There are people who look at animals and they see this amazing tapestry of subspecies. And there's like the barren ground grizzly, the mountain grizzly, the coastal brown bear. And then you have other people in taxonomy who say it's all one species. They just look a little bit different depending on where you go, but it's just one species. I recently read that a guy arguing that all caribou, even the ones in Eurasia, are just a species. And there's no reason to say that it's subspecies.
Well, I don't agree with that.
he acknowledged that he was going out on a limb.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that. I think there's, again, there's lumpers and there's splitters. The caribou that we have in the South Selkirks, what makes them unique to other mountain caribou is their use of the high elevation country during the wintertime.
Okay.
So they're eating lichens, arboreal lichens out of trees.
Is that right?
Old man's beard, the stuff you see growing in the trees.
Out of trees.
Right.
To get above the snow.
Right. So they're standing on whatever, 8 foot of snow, and they're eating lichens that are out of reach the rest of the year. And they're pretty much the only species that can do that. The only, deer and moose and elk aren't up there. So they have sort of a niche market.
Because those animals all leave.
Right. And historically, moose and elk didn't really share that habitat anyway.
Okay.
It's sort of a new thing due to habitat change and other things. So the caribou we have, if we took caribou from the north, they're still mountain caribou, whatever, say we get them from Newfoundland or something, and we drop them, they would not know how to use that habitat. There's a possibility we could train them, though, with pen them together and let them sort of co-mingle long enough and do kind of a soft release or something like that. But
got you.
Augmentations where you just take an animal from a different ecotype and throw them down, it's been a failure.
Can you, I'm going to keep having you stop to explain things that, that people might not know what you mean. Can you explain a hot release and or a hard release and a soft release, which is, this is some fascinating stuff.
Yeah, well, a hard release is pretty basic. You're taking an animal, you're moving it from one spot, and you're just wishing it luck and kicking it loose into a new area, new habitat type, new whatever, mountain range. Some species you can do that with pretty well. Bighorn sheep, you can't store bighorn sheep for very long. They'll kill themselves in the pen. So you're pretty much stuck with doing hard release with that kind of animal. Wolves, they're really easy. They're gonna make a life for themselves wherever you drop them.
Hot or cold?
Yeah, you don't have to like sort of do a soft release. You don't have to do anything to temper them into a new piece of habitat. Caribou, it seems that you do.
You do got to do soft.
What we're going to do, yeah, what we would like to do is build sort of a pen or an enclosure and have a few of our resident animals and then bring some other animals out of one of these other herds and put them all together and leave them to calve together in the spring and then, you know, July or so, open the gates and let them kind of come and go at their leisure until they sort of figure out how to use that landscape. And hopefully they'll mother up to that resident group of animals.
I was first introduced to those terms when I was researching a book I wrote about buffalo or bison. And I did a hunt for a group of introduced buffalo up on the Copper River in Alaska. And it was a classic like hot release story where they took 13 of them and put them in the back of a truck and cut them loose by a mine. And for decades, everyone thought they just all died. But then the herd turns up thriving 150 miles away.
Oh, wow.
And then later people learned that when you're dealing with those, you build a, you know, an enclosure, let them just be in there and taken care of. And one day you just kind of leave the door open.
Right.
But because if you kick them out of the back of the truck, they don't know what happened.
And they
just start moving, trying to find where they were coming from or whatever, right. You know.
Yeah, we had augmentation animals end up in Montana and end up down in Bonner's Ferry in the river valley in the wintertime where, you know, lots of predators, lions were eating them, getting hit by cars, stuff like that.
Because they just had no idea how to where they were and what to do.
They didn't know how to use that landscape at all.
Now, can I assume that, and we got any questions, Callahan?
I just love this topic, so I'm going to be quiet and listen.
Because you and me have run in to mountain caribou.
Yes.
A little ways up.
Yanni.
A little ways up into BC.
Yeah.
And Yanni. A number of times.
Gorgeous.
Oh, my God.
Gorgeous.
Dude. Amazing.
Dream animal. Especially that one we saw last year.
Fabio.
We got to listen to him rutting and grunting. And
oh, wow. Nice.
It yeah, it looked sweet. Like Fabio, man. Just like.
Where was that at?
It was outside of Prince George.
Okay.
Yeah, non-migratory. They just live. They probably have some amount of migration, but they just like are like glued to these mountain ranges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you get up like in the North Slope and you're looking, when you hunt caribou, as I like to do up in the North Slope, you're looking at animals that probably, there's a very strong chance they've never been where they are right now.
Right.
Like you'd be like, that might be his first, you think of animals as having such a defined sense of place, but you look at like a caribou, like as far as there's a very good chance that that thing has never been in this valley before. Just roaming, you know, hundreds of miles.
You know, I do have a question. Why only two collars? And is there a ratio of collars to
Don't answer Cal's question because we haven't established something. Hold it.
Okay.
We haven't established like what it is. Like what is? Okay. Lay off me the situation. We used to have them. Why don't we now? Is someone trying to do something about it?
Okay. Well, we can.
Then we'll do Cal's question.
Yeah, actually, they're going to segue pretty nicely. We had six collars.
No, not that, not collars, caribou.
Well, that's the same story. So we had six collars out and a pretty good cross section of the population, and we've seen all these sources of mortality sort of pop up now that we have information on the caribou. So we have to use our collar data to sort of extrapolate any information that we get from this herd.
I'm trying to go way deeper than that.
Okay. Well, we've lost animals to the highway. Highway 3 cuts right through their middle of their habitat up in British Columbia, so we lose animals on the highway. We have significant habitat change. We've got a lot of habitat protected up there, a lot of good intact old growth, a lot of good high country for them to use.
What is the, like, can you give me a sense of the overall picture of caribou and caribou conservation in the lower 48?
Yeah, I can. We have caribou in the lower 48. They're in tough shape, though. There's been significant habitat changes, although we have lots of places still protected. There's like 12 caribou left in that South Kirk herd.
12.
And they all spend some of their, they all cross back and forth.
Yeah, they're all right along the border.
A dozen.
We're down to a dozen. Yeah, we had.
Where's like the next chunk of like their buddies or cousins or the next herd to the north?
There are 15 subherds in the South Selkirks. So there are other herds around, but they're not connected anymore. There's development in the river bottom, stuff like that.
There's effectively a population of animals that is not breeding with another population of animals. There's only 15 left.
12.
I'm sorry, 12 left.
Right. And that population was doing quite well, actually, in the early 2000s. Like, we were on an increasing trend. We added up to like 46 animals in 2008 or 9.
40.
46. That's a big deal.
Why am I having such a hard time with numbers today? 46.
So they were increasing. They were doing pretty well. And like I said, we have a lot of habitat protections in place. You know, we have road closures. We have different things happening to keep caribou safe. The old growth forest is chopped up a little bit, but there are still places for them to find winter food, which is a problem for some herds. So kind of what's happened, I guess, is we have all this habitat change, and we have all these fragmented habitats, and as we've logged these things over the last, whatever, 100 years, we've created this huge moose population. Okay, so
they love that second growth stuff.
They love it, yeah. 30-year-old cuts are perfect for moose, and we have a lot of those. So as moose have sort of rolled into this country, they've bridged the gap between the river bottoms, which were white-tailed deer, and the caribou elevationally. And it wasn't a big deal until wolf recovery, because now we have this prey species from the river bottoms to the moose up in the mid-elevation to the caribou in the high country. So where before moose were on the landscape, wolves and caribou coexisted because they didn't really run into each other. Now they are encountering each other more often, and we're getting secondary predation, I guess you'd call it.
Go ahead.
Whitetails have traditionally lived along the...
Right.
So you had areas where you had whitetails in the riparian zones along the rivers.
And they would support the wolf population.
And wolves knew about and would hunt them.
Right.
And you had caribou up in the high country. And then moose came in, and now a wolf would find good hunting at all these various elevations, and now finds cause to be drifting around up in caribou country.
That's right. And the high moose population is totally a result of the wildfires and habitat change, I guess, to logging. As the moose population has grown pretty high, it maintains sort of a, I don't want to say an artificially high level of wolves, but higher than what would have been here historically.
They hammer moose pretty hard there.
Yeah, they support, moose and elk are certainly supporting the wolf population. So since 2009, we documented our first wolf pack in Northeast Washington in 2009, and we've seen this precipitous decline in the caribou population from 46 now to 12 over the course of just a few years.
How contentious is that statement you just made?
Not that contentious. You'd be surprised. I think people pretty much recognize that that's the problem.
They do.
Yeah.
Because you get a lot of people who, one, wolves can do no harm, and you get a lot of people who wolves do all harm.
Well.
And you've met them both.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we see them both for sure. Wolves are it's additional predation. Lions were a big problem in the 90s for predation, and when a lion, they're specialists, so they key in on a small subgroup of caribou, and they would kill all of them if you let them. We had collars out then, and if that started happening, we'd respond with dogs and chase a lion, kill it, and the caribou were doing all right.
like you could pinpoint a specific line.
Oh yeah, yeah, they're definitely specialists.
I remember reading a story in Trapper and Predator Caller magazine when I was a kid in the 80s, and it was about like a lion they called like the $100,000 lion because they had done a bighorn sheep reintroduction down in Arizona, and the price tag on the sheep introduction was $100,000, and some Tom moved in there and killed every single one of them.
Oh yeah, and they will. they will key in on a group, and they're pretty effective. Yeah, they had one, and whatever, they don't usually name animals or whatever, but they called this one Mr. Nasty, and it was a big Tom, and he lived in the high country, and he was really tough on the caribou.
Just a caribou.
Yep. When they got rid of him, the herd started coming back up. It made a difference in the population.
Over how many years was that lion in there doing it?
I think it was 2 or 3 years. And then, you know, it started off kind of once, one here and there, and then people started putting together, like, this thing's causing a bunch of trouble, and we started accrediting a lot of the kills to that one.
Okay. And in that circumstance, it's so acute, it's kind of hard to say, no, that's not what's going on. You
right.
know what I mean?
Well, that's an easy fix. That's certainly easier than a wolf problem. You know, there's other options. There's a place in Canada up in the Peace River area, they went in and wiped out most of the moose.
To help caribou.
Yeah. You know, you remove the moose, you remove the primary prey for the wolves, and...
How'd that go over?
It's wildly unpopular. Like, can you imagine trying to explain that to people in, you know, British Columbia and North Idaho and Northeast Washington that we're going to kill all the moose to save the caribou?
Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't go.
No, I can't imagine. I don't like imagining right. having that conversation.
Yeah.
My kids were watching one day an animated like cartoon movie, and they call it, I don't know what it's called, they call it Trapper Wolves. And it's like the plot... there's a wolf family. You gather, it's, you know, BC, I gather. And the bad guys are out trying to live trap the wolves and train them out of helicopters. It's like the Bambi story.
Yeah,
but the bad guys are biologists out trying to trank and relocate wolves to save the caribou.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not kidding you. And then the wolves leave to get away. So it's like, but the end result is the same, because wasn't the whole thing that you didn't want to get relocated, but then they go find a new place to live.
Sure, yeah.
Which is kind of what was going to happen. It's a very confused plot.
Well, it's a children's movie, right?
Like, yeah, but it's like at what point?
Them.
Yeah, but it was just a lot easier when they were just going to go, bad guy's going to kill it. It was like the bad guys are like oddly southern.
Oh, yeah.
Hillbillies. Southern hillbilly biologists who are out trying to trank wolves to save caribou, but they were bad.
So now,
it's the weirdest program. Trapper wolves.
Teaching kids that biologists are bad. Like, don't believe those biologists. They're bad.
Not only bad, but from the South.
So now, caribou, do they have a set of twins every year? Are they single calvers?
Single calvers. Pretty slow. Yeah, reproducers. And then they don't reproduce till they're 2.5, which is, you know, also cost you a year.
Now, so when you guys got rid of Mr. Nasty, the specialist Tom Mountain Lion, that next season, did you guys see a couple extra calves?
Yeah, it was pretty immediate. I mean, really? Obviously, the lion's taking adult animals and sub-adults. It doesn't matter. But yeah, it was a pretty immediate difference when you got rid of him.
Wow.
So a mountain caribou waits till it's 2.5 to have a calf.
Yeah.
And then it'll kick one out every year?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, ideally, our caribou have all been in pretty good condition when they're captured and handled. They're in good condition. They're almost always pregnant. So we have, you know, that tells you that their nutritional needs are probably being met.
So break down the collar situation. Now, Callahan, ask your collar question.
All right.
You have my permission.
So you said before you only have 2 collars out.
Right.
Now, why only 2 collars? Is there like a prime ratio between how many collars you would have for your herd size?
And as part of that, can you explain what you gain by what collaring means and what you gain by collaring something?
Sure. Well, you certainly gain a lot of information by collaring the animals. We figure out how they're using the habitat, where they're crossing the highway, which is a big deal. And then also you're figuring out sources of mortality.
So you're putting a GPS locator on them.
Yeah, they're GPS collars and they have VHF during the daylight hours. So if we go up in an airplane, we can go fly and find them that way. So we get 1 point a day electronically on our computer. And then also with the VHF, we can find them whenever. So with the collar data, we're figuring out sources of mortality, which is really important. We're also figuring out calving areas, which is nice to know.
Like stuff you didn't know before, where they were.
We had an idea. You know, we know the type of habitat, but when you're down to 12 animals, you start kind of pinpointing like individual animals, right?
Yeah, I got you. Instead of thinking about like that herd and that herd, you're like that animal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the reason we're down, we started with six out of, I think we had 17 animals in the herd when we collared. We're down to two collars. One collar is on an animal but dead, so we don't count that. We have.
And you shoot it at it. You shoot a dart at it.
These are net gunned.
Net gunned. Out of a helicopter.
From a helicopter, yep.
And then you jump down.
Yeah, and they mug them, collar them, take whatever samples we need.
And then just cut them loose.
Yeah.
So what do you steal from them when you mug them?
They're taking everything we can. We're taking, you know, hair samples, genetic samples, a fecal, getting weight, body weight, and all the normal sort of measures. And then also fitting them with ear tags and collars. So once we have these collars out, we can start figuring out source of mortality. And since 2009, like we said, this sort of precipitous decline that coincides almost perfectly with wolf recovery. So we kind of all had an idea. But once we had the, you know, the smoking gun, so to speak, with the wolves, we were able to move forward with actually a wolf call. And in British Columbia, they're using helicopters to kill wolves in the recovery area.
So I want to get to that real bad, but I want to back up a couple steps. Okay. How do you know when it died?
We get a mortality signal. If the animal doesn't move for, I think it's 24 hours or maybe 12 hours. So if the collar quits moving, it comes through in an email, you know, you get whatever, your smartphone goes off and you know that you have a dead animal and you know GPS coordinates.
And you hike in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
How far what's the kind of extremes, or is it just easy because of the helicopters to go find the thing once you get the mortality signal?
We hike in. We don't have the funding to just hop in a helicopter whenever we want. So we take off and walk in. It hasn't been too bad. We had one that was actually a vehicle strike up on Highway 3, so that was pretty easy, 400 gotcha. Yards down the hill. Yeah. We had a wolf mortality that was a bit of a hike, you know, and sort of that mid to high elevation stuff in the summertime. But a couple miles. I mean, these things, it's pretty good backcountry area, but there's still a lot of roads around, a lot of trails. It's pretty accessible.
You get the mortality signal and you always want to go look.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You're definitely going to go look.
And what do you, when you find the animal, what kind of, how obvious is it? Like, does it have to be a trained eye, or can most anybody walk up and be like, oh, I can tell what happened to this thing?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be that much training, I guess, but you should have an idea what to look for.
Like, can you tell a lion from a wolf?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you would tell a lion from a wolf. The problem up there is the bear population is so high. They're almost always scavenged. Which is a concern. That's a grizzly bear recovery area also. So, you know, you have to kind of go in cautiously. You want to be, there's sort of a, I don't know, the last one we walked in, there was wolves in the area, there's bears in the area, there's all this other stuff. So you want to sneak in quietly enough that if there's a wolf eating it, you can kill the wolf. But if there's a bear on it, you want to be making enough noise to spook the thing away and don't get rushed if you, you know, show up 10 yards from it all of a sudden.
So what are you looking at when you look at the carcass to tell if it was a predation?
Mm-hmm. Well, lion kills are easy. They're generally buried, squirreled away up underneath a tree or something like that.
They tuck it up against a tree.
Up against a rock bluff or tree or whatever, root wad, something like that. And they'll be covered with debris. Lion,
what do they like to eat off them?
They usually go in behind the front shoulder and start on the lungs and stuff like that. If it's a lactating cow, they'll eat the udder and those areas. But, you know, just depends how long it's been there. They're going to eat it until it gets scavenged generally.
They like the soft tissue.
Yeah.
I heard a guy explain that, or his theory on that is that when they get on, they don't know how long they're going to have it before something gets it.
Right.
And like, they generally go for that stuff that you can just gobble down in a hurry.
Sure.
Like lungs, liver, you know, and then work outward from the easy stuff, work outward.
Right. Yeah, well, that's probably true. I don't know. I haven't really heard that theory or read anything on it, but it makes sense.
It's just a guy making a guess about it, you know.
Sure. You know, liver and stuff like that's pretty high nutritional value.
Yeah.
With 12 animals, is it insanely hard to net gun these things? Like, do they just know the game inside and out?
They've got the game pretty well figured out. So we net gunned the herd last when it was, and I wasn't on the aircraft that day. So I was flying a fixed wing, and we mark their location, and then we call the location in, and a helicopter comes in and net guns them. It's another reason, you know, you asked about why we put six callers out instead of the whole herd or whatever else. There's a risk when you capture the animals that you'll kill them, right? You could experience some capture myopathy if you mug this thing and it just doesn't get back to its feet, and then you have some explaining to do. So we kind of figured we'd do about a third of the herd if we could. And we tried to focus on cows because that's where the best data is going to come from.
Why is that?
Well, cows are certainly more important to the population.
I got you.
They're the reproducers, obviously. So, and we're a little, I don't know if you can call the herd bull heavy necessarily. When there's only 12 animals, you're not really heavy in anything. You're light. But we have probably a disproportionate number of bulls. So we really needed to know more about the cows.
How do you tell, I don't mean to keep harping on this, which is of interest to me. How do you tell, so you know a lion, how do you tell a wolf from a bear kill? Or don't bears hit them hard?
Bears don't really hit them hard. Bears could be a source of calf mortality, but we don't really know that. You know, if a calf dies, there's no way for us to know unless the cow goes with it. So bears may or may not kill a few of the calves, but as far as adult mortality, they're not really a primary source. Wolf kills are pretty spectacular. The last wolf kill we went into, it was like a 30 hours old, maybe. So we got the mort signal. You know, I keep my passport in my work truck, and I was headed towards the border as soon as it came in. And so it was probably actually about 20 hours old. It was fairly recent. And a group of what we think maybe five or six wolves had killed this small bull, and three or four of us went in. The animals were gone, and we found the collar with a pretty good scrap of the hide, maybe 6 foot of the hide, but not much meat attached to that. Found three of the legs and one of the antlers, and the skull was all crushed apart, of course. But we put, I mean, I put all of the caribou remains in my backpack and walked out. And this thing was fresh. Like, it didn't smell bad. It was like...
Packed them out.
It was fresh. Really? So when wolves kill it, you know, they don't leave a lot. I mean, they're eating the ribs. They're eating most of the bones.
Wow, man.
And okay. The head's crushed, kind of, I want to...
Yeah, when you said of course.
Because they're yeah, you said of course, so they're going after the brain matter and eyeballs and...
Yeah, they'll chew on the head.
I've come back to where we've killed elk after grizzlies got on what we left, and you'll find some balls of hair,
mm-hmm.
and then the back of the skull.
Yeah, it's pretty tough back there. It's hard to crunch
like
that.
The frame and the area around the hole that your spinal cord goes in, you'll find like a softball size hunk of that. And other than that, they eat the entire face off that thing.
Yep.
And then pass bone fragments all over the place.
Right. And, you know, you find the rumen content, but the guts are gone.
Yep.
And you find a big
water. It looks like someone emptied out a bag of lawnmower clippings, you know, and it's because they ate the stomach but left the...
Yep. So if we found a more complete carcass, the one we found that was struck on the highway was fed on by wolves and also had a black bear on it when we showed up. So we're throwing sticks at that thing, trying to scare him away. And
so it got hit by a car.
Yeah.
Wolves came, found it, ate some. A bear came, started eating some more. And how much time had passed?
One day. I mean, this is
a lot of activity.
It's a predator-rich environment.
Wow.
So it's like 400 yards off the main highway. You know, we find as much scrap as we can. We only found one pre-mortal bite mark. So it probably killed by some, you know, finished off, I guess.
So you can analyze the hide and tell what bites that were alive and bites that were not?
Sure. Yeah, you know, if there's bruising on a bite mark, generally you can kind of guess that it was alive when it was, you know, chewed on.
Yeah, I heard that because I remember this guy up in Alaska, a gold miner, I think he was a placer miner, found a step bison. I think bison latifrons, they used to call it. I can't remember which one, but like a longhorn bison, and it had been preyed on by an American lion, like a lion species that used to live in the Great Plains and up into Alaska. And they could tell by this thing was so well preserved in the permafrost, they could tell where it had been bit before it died.
Really? The bruising was still intact?
Yeah, it hit it on the base of the neck.
Nice.
Yeah, because it had like bled there, and then the rest of the body where it had chewed hadn't bled through.
Hmm.
So when you can only pack out a 6 foot chunk of hide, can you tell that kind of stuff from it?
Well, we're looking at it in the field and trying to make a decision out there. But yeah, I mean, we're going to pack it out anyway. We get, if it's not a collared animal, you know, we found two dead caribou earlier this month. A hiker reported them, and one of the tribal biologists from the Kootenai tribe hiked up and gathered those.
What did kill those?
We have no idea.
People?
No, probably not.
Is poaching a big problem with those caribou?
It hasn't been in a long time. Most people that hunt up there know, and there's signs and, you know, educational materials scattered out in the woods. Now, it wasn't poached. It was a really nice bull, actually. A big set of antlers still laying up there intact.
But no saying what happened to it.
No, no idea. There's two of them near one another, which maybe makes you think there's a predator work in that area, but it's anybody's guess.
And then tell me again the number you had collared at one time.
We had six at one time.
And there was how many alive at that time?
I think there were 17 in the herd then.
And so the four that died, with have you continuously collared throughout that period, or you just had six and now you have two?
Right. Yeah, we put six out at one time, like 2 years ago. One of those collars has died, and three of those caribou have died. So we have two collars still working for us.
And then the three that died, one got hit by a car.
One got hit by a car, and two were wolf mortalities.
Okay.
And is the risk just too high at this point with a 12-animal group to try to collar anything else?
We've talked about collaring some more. We're trying to put together a program. We're trying to come up with a plan to, you know, augment the herd and do some other stuff, and we want to do everything kind of at once so we're not handling these animals more than we have to.
I got you. You don't want to be out harassing them all the time.
Right. And, you know, like you asked, they do get smart about the helicopter. When they, you know, animals that have been captured by a helicopter figure that out pretty quickly. And they're in tough enough country that if they really put their mind to it, they could get away from a helicopter easily.
I got a buddy who is a waterfowl researcher, and he did a lot of capture netting for birds. And he was always very afraid of killing the birds.
Oh, yeah.
And his count, he wasn't getting enough birds. He wasn't getting data on enough birds. And he was telling me how his advisor at the time said, if you're not killing birds, you're not working hard enough. Meaning, like, get out there and get data. But sure. with a population the size you're talking about, it's one thing if you're doing mallards.
Right. Yeah. If you kill, you know, 8% of the population with one bad shot, you've got some explaining.
Yeah, but I imagine if you guys had a mortality, it'd make the news.
Probably, yeah.
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 So is it growing right now or shrinking?
It's pretty steady right now. Well, I mean, whatever. We were at 15 a few years ago, and we're at 12 now. So we have some documented reproduction this year. We've got some calves on trail camera, so that's good. The only real complete census we get during the wintertime, like March, we'll fly and count the animals again. But right now, you know, the 12 don't stay together. They sprinkle out across the landscape in ones and twos.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So any real census this time of year is impossible.
Explain augmentation, how that would work.
Well, hopefully, it'll be, like I said, a soft release. We'll bring some animals in from one of the British Columbia herds that's nearby. Hopefully we'll get animals that kind of know how to use that landscape that stay high in the wintertime. If we don't, I would still want to augment. Even if we had animals that maybe didn't know that routine, we'd hope that we could train them.
And are the people who the source herd, the people whose jurisdiction that is, are they open to the idea of you taking of some animals coming from their herds to augment?
They're not too excited about it. We've made a formal request. We're working out details on that kind of stuff. But herds all across that southern part of the Selkirks are in a decline.
That's what I can imagine. So someone's like, just because I got 100 doesn't mean I feel like I got animals to spare.
Right. That herd has declined. You know, the main herd of whatever we call this, a sub-herd, the main herd has declined pretty significantly. There's efforts going on. There's maternal penning efforts going on at two different places in Canada where they're capturing cows that are pregnant and putting them in a pen and trying to rear the calves to like 3 months, 4 months old before they turn them loose.
Because, just to give them an enhanced chance that they'll survive.
Because their highest chance of getting killed is early in life. And
are those wolves keening on calves?
Up there, well, they've done a pretty serious wolf removal in those areas. Okay. So where they're turning those animals loose, they've done a serious wolf removal, and that has helped. A lion actually killed like four animals at one time up there right after release. So you look at this weird spike in the data and it's like, you got to kind of put an asterisk next to that. That's something that maybe we didn't know we could have avoided, but now we know it's probably not going to happen again.
Do you get involved in the predator control?
Not really. I have hounds. If a lion killed a caribou, I would be up there with the dogs. That hasn't happened since we put the collars out, but I would obviously drop what I was doing to get the dogs up there and take care of that.
So you're a lion hunter?
Right.
Can I come with you lion hunting?
Yeah. You had some of my lion last year in Missoula.
Oh, that was your lion?
Yeah. Yeah. Nice, Nick Claro and I joined the little contest.
That was awesome.
We didn't even get a participation award.
Not up to me.
So
I like the look, though. I'll remember that look.
So when, so you hunt lions, but you haven't personally gone after lions that were after the caribou.
Well,
like whose job is that?
Nobody has that job necessarily.
No.
I work for the outfitter up at Priest Lake. That's Selkirk Guiding Outfitting has the area that goes all the way to the Canadian border.
Okay.
And we target those animals early in the season, but as the snow gets too deep, it ends up being a 30-mile snowmobile ride just to get to the, you know, any good areas. So early in the season, we try to take out some animals that are potential caribou predators.
They're in the caribou recovery zone.
Right.
But that's completely just your own
doing.
That's
just hunters,
that's like
yeah.
legal over-the-counter lion yeah. hunting, have nothing to do right. with government-sanctioned predator control.
No, there's none of that. There has been some, you know, there's no female quota up in the panhandle. There's no, you know, anybody can buy a tag over-the-counter, that kind of stuff. That you can run hounds in Idaho. You can't do that in Washington. In British Columbia, they've allowed a hound hunter to take two cats per winter or whatever, but it's remote. It's backcountry stuff. It's tough to access. You know, in the wintertime, the cats move down low, the caribou stay up high. You could kill a cat that may or may not ever travel to that high country. So you really don't know if you're getting the right cat or not.
And is the wolf control in the, let me get this straight first. In the U.S., so I know that these animals are on the border moving back and forth, but in the U.S. portion of the range, or in like what we'd call immediately potential range, like a place that could very well, maybe next month might have a caribou on it, is the U.S. doing in a government way, are they doing predator control?
No.
To assist caribou, but Canada is.
Canada is. And
what's the what is the argument against doing it to facilitate the comeback of caribou in the U.S.? Like, well, predator protectionists, or what is it?
Remember, you're dealing with wildlife that's managed by the states now.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two different jurisdictions there, actually three if you count Canada, right? So you've got North Idaho, where wolf hunting is liberalized, but it's hard. It's thick, it's steep. There's a couple of trappers up there that are finding some success, but there's no government effort. There's no bounty, there's no anything like that. Washington, the wolves are still a protected species. We yep. can't trap them, we can't hunt them. So those wolves on that side of the border are safe. There's no real government control effort. There's no, like I said, bounties, anything else. Idaho has done what it could with liberalizing the seasons. But, yeah, I don't think we're going to see any kind of government effort to kill wolves in the states. It's just too contentious of an issue with big groups.
Yeah, but you feel that there is a convincing case to make, or there is a case to make that would be one of the steps. I'm not saying I advocate it or
absolutely.
Not, but that would be one of the steps towards recovering caribou.
It is a very important step, and it's been interesting watching people kind of come around as they learn more about this the caribou situation. And we've had, you know, conservation groups even not come out with like raving support of the wolf call, but like saying we recognize that it has to happen, we don't like it, but to save this species, we know that that's part of the deal.
Yeah.
So if we can get groups even to come on with that kind of support, that's fine. We're not asking for their money. We don't expect them to pay for the wolf removal, but they need to recognize that if we're going to save caribou, it's going to have to be sort of a predator free zone for a little while.
Got you. Now let me ask you a question that'll probably make you uncomfortable. Maybe not. Let's say God came down from outer space and said, you have absolute authority you are the caribou czar, okay? And I'm tasking you with recovering caribou in the lower 48. If you fail, I will kill every human on Earth. What are the things that you would do? And you have three things you can do.
Three things, okay.
Yep.
Well,
or everyone on Earth dies.
Well, they're multi-pronged. It's like a dream.
It was meant to be a nightmare.
It's a multi-pronged approach. So we would have to supplement the herd. We absolutely have to bring new animals in, or we're going to start seeing genetic drift and issues genetically.
What's genetic drift?
It's where you get this small isolated population. They basically become so inbred that their productivity falls.
Okay.
So we would start seeing that. We have to bring animals in. And if I could just snap my fingers and like get animals, I'd get all of them.
And the complications there are, you want to draw animals who are coming from a similar habitat type and know how to utilize the environment. However, all of those animals are coming from herds that themselves are in questionable condition.
Right. That's right. So I guess if I could, let's get rid of your situation and just make a more perfect situation. Like if I had unlimited money and like support from
and everyone doesn't have to die.
You have God on your side. You have all the money you
need. That's right. I've got God on my side, but nobody has to die in this.
Okay, so yeah, you're just like, you have unlimited funding.
And, right. Yeah. So in a perfect world, we could get our hands on a handful of caribou from all of these groups for a couple of years.
How many?
You know, if we put probably 10 a year for a few years out there.
Oh, did you say that you're essentially willing to borrow them?
We would be willing to borrow them.
Once we recover.
Yeah. If we could make our herd into a source population, that would be fantastic. Obviously, that's going to be down the road a little ways, but we were on a pretty strong upward trajectory. We were going from, 26 animals to 46 animals in the course of, half a decade or something. So we were doing really well.
Kentucky, look at their elk population.
Right.
They got elk from other states, and now they're a lead source herd for eastern elk populations.
And look, isn't the same case with the Nunavak muskox?
Yeah, but that's kind of confused because but yes. Yes.
Right. So we've got
experimental population
is now
turned loose, and then it later becomes a source for restocking.
We've got bighorn sheep in the same area as the caribou that are a source population and have been for years.
Okay. Borrow the animals and give them back later.
Yeah. It's a high interest loan. We get that. But so if we take these animals, we could then do our maternal pen. We'd capture some of our resident animals, let them calve with the, and let all the cows calve together, all of our augmentation animals and our resident animals, and give them 3 or 4 months in the pen to sort of co-mingle, get to know one another, whatever, and kick them loose. And recognizing that the augmentation animals are going to have probably higher mortality, but we'd have collars on all of them. Once you're handling them, you may as well put a collar.
Higher mortality so that they don't know the ins and outs.
Yeah, yeah. You're just going to have that. And we recognize that's probably going to be part of the deal. But even if you had, 75% mortality, that'd be fantastic. Or 75% survival, that'd be fantastic. Yeah. So if we could do that for several years, we could get this trajectory back. And, like I said, the habitat protections are in place. If we continued with the wolf control and, I don't know if we need to ramp up the cougar control or anything else. Bears aren't really a big problem, but, keep kind of doing what we're doing. We just need animals.
All right. Do you remember long ago when they were trying to recover the Florida panther.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there was a period of time when people thought the Florida panther was gone, and some lion hunter a guy down there kept saying, no, there's some still here. This is an interesting story. A guy down there says, no, there's still some around. People are like, oh, bullshit, they're all gone. He goes and finds some lion hunter from Arizona, has him come out to Florida, and they start pounding lions. And people are like, geez, stop. He goes, just stop telling me there's none here, because here's a pile of dead ones. Later, they wanted to recover them. They tried all this kind of stuff. And there was a lot of, and some people came up with this idea, like, okay, what is the Florida panther? Like, sure, we're going to lose the Florida panther, but let's try to at least save the idea of panthers in Florida. And what they wanted to do was, let's just go get some from the Rocky Mountains. It's like, it's the same species. Their offspring are sexually viable, right? But some people are so fixated on saving the Florida panther that they were willing to let panthers in Florida go away if they couldn't save like that population. Why not go get a whole shitload of them from Alaska and just cross your fingers? Like, you're down to 15.
12.
It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. You're down to 12. Like, let's say 5 years from now, you're out. I'm not just saying like you, it's like it's your fault. But 5 years from now, people involved in this effort are still going, please, how about a few caribou over here? Like, what is the argument with being like, okay, let's do plan B. It's not as good, but it's viable that we could go get 200 of the things.
Well, like I said, I don't know. If we can train other, you know, like if we could go back to whatever, Newfoundland or someplace and get a bunch of mountain caribou that kind of know the steep landscape that aren't huge migrators. Uh-huh. I mean, that would be the big problem, right? You drop a bunch of these animals that do 100 miles.
You put some barren ground caribou on, they're just going to split.
They're going to cruise someplace. So
then your money's gone.
Yeah.
Your money's gone and the caribou are who knows where.
Right.
Yeah. Down in Iowa.
And you've burned a ton of like social capital too, right? You just like
I got you.
Played your hand.
Social capital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you want to try to do something that's going to work.
No, I see. I mean, I knew there was a good answer for it, but it's just something that, you know.
Yeah, that's a tough one. If we got animals, like I said, there are other mountain caribou that drop to lower elevation in the winter. There's a possibility that we could sort of change that behavior, but it's a pretty strong instinct for some of them. Like I said, we're just going to experience mortality if we do that.
Gotcha.
And people just need to recognize that. Like, if we get 50% mortality, that's still 50% survival. That's something. That's, you know, additive to the herd.
Yeah. So it really seems like the best thing to do is try to get some of these ones from a bit north.
Right.
We should go up and get some of those ones we know about, Cal.
Got a horse trailer.
I like it. Like, I'm down.
Horse trailer biology instead of bucket biology.
Yeah, there used to be, do you remember? Never mind. It's such a weird digression. Okay, what else? You still have powers, ultimate power. That's it?
It's a short list. Yeah, we don't need magic. We just need some animals. Like I said, with habitat protections, they're pretty much in place. I would do a highway, like a wildlife overpass on Highway 3, because the animals, like, they flirt with that highway all the time. Actually, I've got a fantastic photo somebody emailed me of an awesome bull caribou and two cows and a calf, and they're standing on the shoulder of the road. They still use salt on the highway.
Yeah,
I would change
they come
that.
Down to get that.
Yeah, so they're down there licking, and there's the caribou warning sign, and then in the background, like, there's a semi bearing down on the. I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah. This is just a fantastic photo. Shows all these problems. If we had a
wildlife over, I noticed you mentioned over. I was reading a piece about overpasses and underpasses, mm-hmm. and when I've done the underpasses, they found a correlation between animals' willingness to use it with the steepness of the walls.
Oh, really?
They found that when walls got to a certain pitch and they couldn't see, they did not want to go through that thing. The ones where they pitched the walls out enough where he didn't feel like he was going beneath a ledge, they were more willing to use it, and they preferred overpasses to underpasses.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, visibility. I mean, like, it's a tough sell to be like, hey, man, go into this here box canyon.
Right. <know? laughs> Yeah. Especially for...
On the genetic side of things, like, what do you think your timeline is with your... You got 12 incredibly valuable caribou right now.
15. That's a joke.
12. And, like, what's your time frame? When are you like, we need new genetics in this herd by this time, or... You know, else everybody's going to be the slow cousin.
I don't think anybody's really came up with a definite timeline that way. Obviously, we're trying to just stop the bleeding from this herd, right? Like, genetics are not...
Because it was 61?
It was 46, maybe up to 50, I can't remember. 46 for sure in 2009.
Okay.
When did you come on?
I started working on the Caribou Project, 5 years or so.
Yeah. So you've seen a lot of this play out.
Yeah. Yeah. From the basic wolf recovery onward, seen like the bad years.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't, in this, in playing God, you want more animals.
No, he wasn't playing God.
Oh, no, God's given him the power.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry. Extension of. But you have more critters. You have trying to fix some of like the habitat fragmentation, which is that highway, right? Doing an overpass. But not any kind of predator control.
No, I would still have predator control going. Okay. Yeah. And those are the kind of those are the three big ones, you know.
And that would be aggressive, like is going on up in British Columbia.
Yeah, it would be, you know, targeted wolf removal. We're not anti-wolf, and I don't want to come off that way. We don't mind having wolves on landscape. That's just part of the deal. We don't want them cohabitating with the caribou.
Right now, because their population is
for sure. Right now, if we had 1,000 caribou, it wouldn't make any difference if one got picked off every once in a while. This is pretty incidental. Yeah. You know, obviously wolves aren't making a living on the caribou; they wouldn't last long. But any incidental take when you have just a handful of animals is pretty critical. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we would continue with the predator control.
What percent chance is it that they'll all die?
I don't know.
Likely or not likely?
Well, at least, you know, from the...
Because once there's four, they're done, right? I mean, is there a point at which they're done?
There is a point, and I don't think anybody wants to think about that. I don't know what that number would be. The Kalispell tribe, you know, my boss, we're not going to quit working on the caribou until they're gone all the way.
But it won't end if they're gone, though, right? Because then you can still...
There's still a recovery area. There's still all this other stuff. But, I mean, if we can't get animals to augment the population when there's animals there... Imagine trying to pull those political strings and get... Yeah, it'd be impossible.
Are you married?
I am.
Okay. You come home and you're like, I don't know what the point is. I feel like I have the wrong career. Why do I bother? And your wife wants to cheer you up. She says...
Well, Stacy's super supportive of the caribou stuff. She cares about the caribou and likes
that. Yeah,
that's
what I'm getting at. Why? Yeah. Why does anybody care about the caribou?
Well, I think because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, but I was listening to a thing where Donald Trump was talking about how there's no reason to let water out of the Sacramento River because it's just a stupid 3-inch fish. And he was kind of like ridiculing the fish, the Delta smelt. He's like teasing the Delta smelt.
Sure.
I imagine there's a lot of people who kind of tease the caribou, right? Like, but why go through all this?
There's a petition right now to get them delisted. Like, it's the most imperiled species in the lower 48, and there's a petition in front of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to take them off of the endangered species list and remove the recovery area.
Motivated by?
That's by the snowmobile closure.
Gotcha.
You know, they've closed winter recreation up there. And a big portion of North Idaho and Northeast Washington and Canada. And those groups are upset and they, whatever, maybe they have something of a point. The caribou haven't been in some of that area for a long time. There's maybe an opportunity to have that talk with them, but you know, to pull the animal off the list and remove the recovery area is ridiculous.
Yeah. So it's not so much the animal. They just want to remove the recovery area.
Right.
Recovery area restrictions.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there are people that, you know, they see the cost of what this stuff, you know, is going to, in total, I hate to even guess what it might cost to recover caribou. Like, in your perfect world, I have unlimited funding, right?
But why do people not even know about the caribou? I mean,
this is only 15.
Right, yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
But, there's much crazy emphasis on the last big reintroduction success story and protecting that big success story to crazy extent. Like, but here's this 12 animal herd.
Yeah, you got 1,800 grizzlies in Montana, and people act like they know them all by name.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, if they're going to delist grizzlies in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, I'd be like, but what if old Snaggle Scarface gets killed? What happens then?
The whole Yellowstone economy is going to crash and burn. People don't even know.
Here you got where you could actually know all their names, and people don't know or care that they're there. How do they not make the charismatic megafauna list?
You just took the words out of my mouth. They're not charismatic enough. I don't know. They don't pay the bills, right? There are no conservation groups getting on board with caribou recovery because you're not going to get some crazy cat lady in New York City to send you $40 to save the caribou. She doesn't care about the caribou.
Send you $400 to save a,
that's right.
Save a grizzly.
Someone with claws and teeth, she will absolutely care about. So people, maybe they just don't relate to caribou. I don't know.
Have you spent much? Have you got to spend much time up in areas up in good caribou country?
Yeah, oh yeah,
dude, it's amazing.
It's fantastic. It's beautiful.
You know, we've hunted up there where be there for a few days, and every day hundreds come through.
Yeah,
you can never not see them.
I haven't spent time in that caribou country.
I've also hiked my ass off trying to find one, but I'm saying I did have the experience right. of like what everybody dreams yeah. about, right? Yeah. Where they're just like coming and coming and coming and coming and coming. And you wake up the next day and they're coming and coming and coming and coming. It's not even hunting. It's like yeah. you sort of eventually be like, okay, we should probably go get one, I guess.
Right.
No, it's just like, it's like observation.
The places know? That these caribou live are fantastic in the Selkirks too. There's, you know, there's lynx, there's wolverine, there's fishers, you know, this whole suite of rare and cool species that a lot of people don't really realize we have up there. It's pretty fantastic country, really.
When I look at things, I always try to like draw to make definitions, you know, or try to struggle to find ways to qualify stuff. And one way, when I think of wilderness, right, a way to define it, and it's a very difficult term to deal with, but I always think a barometer of wilderness would be that the species are intact, right? That it, like all the pieces are there. I realize that's tricky because that means you're kind of, that definition's bad, not bad, but that definition isn't great because you're sort of ruling out the possibility of wilderness in the eastern U.S.
Right. And that's the
to
thing.
To some degree.
You know, with the delisting, the group that wants to, or whatever, if caribou, let's say caribou did go away, the recovery area would exist still.
Okay.
It would take an effort to get that recovery area removed because, you know, that's still potentially caribou habitat. So people don't really recognize that. You know, with the wilderness thing, yeah, I'm sort of reticent to say that the species have to be there, but certainly, like you said, the pieces have to be there. The habitat to meet the life needs of that species should be there.
What was the last legally killed caribou by a hunter in the U.S.? I feel like it was in the 20s, wasn't it?
No, it was later than that. I want to think it was like 1959 or something, but I could be wrong.
A guy legally killed one. Do you know where it was?
I don't.
I remember reading a thing about it, but I can't remember what it was.
Yeah. I know that there was a couple poached in maybe the 90s even.
Really?
Pretty late, yeah.
Poached by dudes who wanted the heads or poached by dudes who were pissed off about caribou and pissed off about Endangered Species Act issues?
Well, we don't know. We wouldn't know either of those cases, right? Because somebody that's pissed off about the caribou is probably not going to poach one and then go down and turn it in.
Yeah.
These were mistaken identities.
Oh, they were.
These are people that killed a caribou and thought it was something else, and they self-reported or whatever.
Yeah. Dude, people shoot llamas thinking they're elk.
I was just going to bring that up. And he was a native Montanan.
I remember going to a fish and game check station and seeing a thing. They had a thing up that says, this is a llama. this is an elk. This is a llama. This is the Dalai Lama.
What I thought was funny about that is, okay, he makes the mistake, right? He makes a mistake.
It's happened twice.
Which is bad. I mean, you shouldn't do that anyways. But then he brings it to the check station like it's an actual cow elk. And I'm like,
yeah. Packed it out. Probably gutted it.
Yeah. One question I have for you is that, like, hunters have been, you know, this they've been part of this great restoration across the country, right? And so, you know, white-tailed deer, elk, antelope, turkeys, they've all come back because of hunters.
Right.
And so you have this caribou population, which it would take, it sounds like, long, long time before we'd ever have a hunting population of caribou.
Yeah, you could probably remove that from your yeah. life goals, right. the caribou right. more 48.
But it's a species. We've done it before. Like, I guess that question is, so like when you talk about like the snowmobilers, they don't like them because of their area got shut down. I get that piece. But why aren't hunters more engaged in trying to like establish this population? And is that part of the whole like conversation that you guys are having?
Well, I don't know that it's really part of the conversation. It's certainly frustrating though. They're such a cool species and they're whatever, you know, you talk about what hunters want and different things. And some hunters want caribou back because it's the right thing to do and they mm-hmm. recognize they're probably never going to get the opportunity to hunt one. But you know, their antler to body size ratio is like the highest in the deer family. They have huge antlers for their body size. They're very, you know, they're cool animal. They have heavier horns than the barren ground animals. They're they're a beautiful animal. It would be fantastic to hunt one someday, mm-hmm. or for our grandkids to hunt one someday. I'm sort of surprised the hunting community hasn't jumped on board more. There was a group, the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council was a big partner in the original augmentation, and they had people helping, and they put up money and stuff like that. So that's kind of the last sort of hunting group that coughed anything up.
And did they walk away because it just wasn't working the way they wanted?
No, they walked it. They walked away because the project was over and it was working. I said, and the caribou were coming back. Mm-hmm. That's what people, you know, this hasn't been like this slow decline. This has happened quickly, and we have a pretty good idea why.
We're not, yeah, I'm guilty. This is coming from a guy who's guilty of not having not done diddly squat toward helping caribou, in the lower 48. Like, I haven't done anything. I'm just learning about it right now. But I do think that people should care about this kind of thing and be involved in it, because I don't think it's right to have animals vanish from the face of the earth because of things we've screwed up. And I don't care if you need to draw the inspiration to adhere by that from religion or just as a humanist or wherever it comes from. It's just like, it just seems to me categorically wrong to eliminate species from Earth. You know?
Yeah, I totally agree.
It's like just a sin in all things. It's like whether you feel that we have been given domain of the Earth or whether we just happen to need to feel that way, you know, whether we got it from a celestial being or not, we just can't let things vanish. I think the reason it kind of falls under hunters' purview is because hunters have done recovery of all of big game animals. And it's like, just because I think we have to take responsibility for big game animals, even if they're not going to be our game, you know?
Right.
And I think that the guys who first got involved in recovering bighorn sheep were hardly motivated by the idea of someday I'm going to get to hunt one. I met a lot of guys who worked on the Kentucky elk reintroduction who've given their entire volunteer lives. And what are the odds of them ever drawing a tag? They'll never do it. The guys who know most about those animals and work hardest on behalf of those animals never hunt them. You know, it's not always about like, well, can I hunt one?
Right.
You know, just people don't look at it that way.
There's sort of it's a weird thing, and it's this intrinsic reward or whatever that we get from the recovery effort. But it's the same feeling probably that the cat lady in New York gets sending $40 to save a wolf, right?
Yeah.
She's probably never going to see a wolf. She's never going to hear a wolf howl, but it means something to her that they're there. So,
yeah,
similar kind of thing.
I argue in favor quite often lately of delisting grizzlies in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And people are often like, oh, yeah, because you want to hunt one. It's like, one, I don't. It would take me a long time to explain why I don't, but I don't. I will never. If I could put in for a tag right now, I wouldn't put in for it. It's just, I'm not interested in that population in that way. Two, if I did want to, I would have probably, somewhere well less than 0.25% or a quarter of a percent or so odds of ever drawing the tag, particularly as a non-resident. It's going to be a lottery draw if they do a hunt. They're going to be giving out a handful of tags. They're going to have hundreds of thousands of applicants. You're not going to do it. But people can't help but just make that jump. That, like, you must be in this for something, some dark motivation.
Right.
It would be a good way to prove them wrong for hunters to get involved in this and look at, okay, it's a depleted game species. It's not like putting turkeys on the ground where in 5 years you're going to be hunting for the things. It's just you're not, but we should almost, I feel like hunters should, especially people that live around that area, get involved in the same way that we've always gotten involved in recovering wildlife. It's just a long, slow process. Yeah, maybe sometime in 200 years or 100 years is going to be a hunting season for them. Who knows? I tend to doubt it.
Well, right. Right now there's a group, and it's pretty much all agency folks putting together a plan. But, when there's a decision made, there will be an opportunity for people to step forward. And we've talked about, actually, I've volunteered backcountry hunters and anglers as working on the maternal pen. If we ever have this maternal pen, it's going to be rad. It's going to be way up in the mountains. It's going to be like, you know, 10-acre pen with a wall tent and a cabin that we have to maintain throughout the whole winter. And it's going to be probably a volunteer effort. So, I mean, there are going to be opportunities for people to step to the plate. Right now, there's not, unless you want to go, you know, cougar hunting in North Idaho or Northeast Washington, or go wolf hunting or something like that. You can, you know, play that kind of role, but
there's not a lot of things for people to do
right now. No. Hopefully, people, you know, it gets to be more of a mainstream conversation, and people recognize that the caribou are still there, and there are people trying to do things and support them, whatever, when the time comes, through, you know, sending letters of support and different things like that. But
yeah,
that's a tough
situation. you need some agency to say, okay, here are some animals. If they do that, do you got the money?
We would find the money.
Is the money there?
We would find the money.
What would be a price per animal that would not be surprising, that would be not surprising how cheap or how expensive it was? Or doesn't it work that way?
You know, I don't even know. I have, like I said, saving this species is more important to me probably than the budget would be.
Could it potentially be actually like, okay, we'll sell them to you, or does it not work that way?
I don't know if it works that way.
Like I said, we're not trading.
We're not getting these from the United States. This is coming from British Columbia. British Columbia is a strong partner for us. They want the herd to exist for a number of reasons. One, it's their southernmost herd. It's the only herd that extends into the United States. And if they want the United States to remain a strong partner, they need to keep this herd around.
Yeah.
And we are a strong partner, and both the tribes are strong partners, and the states and everything else. So, I'm not trying to like paint Canada in a negative light. They want the herd to be there. But they have, there's a cost to them to move those animals down.
Yeah.
With potential failure. There's also potential reward. And that's what we're trying to sell them.
So does the decision rest on like some individual's desk, or is it more complex than that?
I hope it's more complex than that. I'm not really sure. Yeah. I don't know who's making the decision at there. It's a high level in Canada. You know, it's not some field biologist that's going to go do this. It's high level.
Yanni?
Interesting stuff.
Got any thoughts on all that?
Can you just real quick explain, just because I'm still like lost and like very early on caribou land. We've got mountain that we've been talking about. We've got the barren ground, which is pretty much all of Alaska. Are the ones on the Kenai, are those mountain or barren ground?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
But what are the other caribou?
Woodland, mountain, bear, caribou. Then there's the Labrador. There's one they call that. Then you have reindeer in Eurasia.
Right.
But in North America, we just have
four. They all have the same Linnaean name down to the third word.
Right. I think they can reproduce too.
Yeah.
I think.
No, they can.
Yeah, reindeer and caribou. I mean, that was one of the deals, right?
So there's like five, I think there's five kinds. Woodland, mountain, barren ground, Labrador, and then there's another one.
Yeah, so we're dealing with range for Tarandus, woodland, mountain, caribou, whatever. It's sort of, you can use either name to describe the South Selkirks. We go by mountain caribou because I don't know why. We just do. But if somebody called them a woodland caribou, I probably wouldn't jump up and correct them.
Okay.
They're definitely different than the stuff we have in Alaska or in the Northwest Territories up north.
Dude, when I saw those ones that I saw, and we were hunting bears, and we ran into some, it was like, you're looking at
they're very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you look at it, you're like, that's not the kind I know about. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Badass looking things, though.
Yeah, they're cool. They're you know, heavier, thick, obviously thick for big, giant feet for snowshoeing.
Yeah.
Heavier antlers. You know, their antlers don't do the wobble when they jog.
Yeah, no, that was cool. Got any more things you want to say, Giannis?
No.
I like that red t-shirt.
I'll get you one.
Got any concluding thoughts? You kind of talked the whole time, but you still have a concluding thought. It can be anything that has nothing to do with this.
No, this is great. I like, hopefully more people just become aware that we have those caribou. Like I said, I'm not, this isn't an ask. This isn't like I'm, you know, broadcasting out trying to get people to send checks or anything, but just letting people know that they're still around. And when the time comes, it might become an ask, like send a letter of support, do whatever.
Yeah. I would ask that they take some of the energy they're spending toward saving recovered things and put it into things that are absolutely not recovered.
Oh, yeah.
Because you talked really about social capital. We are burning a tremendous amount of social and political capital by arguing over things that by any scientific definition are recovered, and ignoring things that are on the are in absolute peril because of a friend of mine pointed out no one has calendars anymore because of Instagram worthiness. It drives me nuts. Cal.
I mean, collars. I keep thinking about two things. There's this old movie called The Rare Breed. Did you ever see that?
No, I'd like to.
Rare Breed, Jimmy Stewart. It's about getting Hereford cattle out in Texas.
Oh.
It's supposed to be like the start of Hereford cattle, but they'd...
No, man, this is right up my alley, though, yeah.
Giant ranch in Texas with these wild-ass longhorns that are just, you know, free ranging it out there, and then they go round up these things every year, and that's how they run those that beef operation. Well, the only way this rancher is going to give this Hereford bull his shot at commingling out there is to just do it like everybody else. Just turn him loose on the range and wish him good luck, and we'll see you in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And that was supposedly like the start of the Hereford thing. I keep thinking about that, like, okay, hard release. Here we go. But the other part of this is the like public knowledge just kills me. Like, would it be more beneficial to destroy part of this caribou range by building like a spur road off of Highway 3 so you could take busloads of tourists in there and be like, look, caribou.
Only 12 left.
All 12.
And people would be like, holy shit, I need to get involved.
Right.
Well, certainly if we had a maternal pen, we'd have some opportunity to, you know, let people peek through the fence or whatever, and or go in and feed them or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be looking for volunteers to gather lichens. That's going to be a huge job. Imagine trying to get enough moss to feed 10 caribou for a winter.
Yeah, that might create awareness and generate some press.
Get some school kids out there collecting moss.
Certainly locally, which is important.
They eat that moss.
They love it.
Oh, yeah. I knew a gal that worked at the large animal research station there in Fairbanks, and she was working on the caribou, and she did that. They went up to the North Slope and collected with like a group of 20 people, just filled up, like, I forget, they were recycled, not lawns, like grain sacks or maybe, and just stuffed them full of lichen. And she said, I think for most of the week, they didn't get it every day. And she said when that sack would come out, because the pen's pretty big, but those suckers were just running.
Really?
Yeah.
But you know the stuff he's talking about, that grows up on the trees.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they weren't collecting that. But yeah, that
do they eat that one that looks kind of seaweedy too?
Yeah, the green stuff, nasty looking.
Looks almost like something you'd find under the water.
Right.
They like that?
Yeah, they'll eat that.
Yeah.
There's plenty
what of... What is that? I've always wondered what that species is, man. Like,
I don't know.
I used to take a hiking into the hot springs, and you'd always like see so much of that stuff. I should look that up.
You know, if you cut a tree down, though, the deer and elk, they eat that stuff out of the tops of trees.
My buddy used to be a surveyor in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and he says you'd be out there cutting a line through all that bog land, you know, and just the sound of the chainsaw. So he says you'd cut your line, set everything up, and you had to hurry up to shoot the lines because deer would come toward the chainsaw sound. And you couldn't even look down your thing. Like when you're shooting the lines, you couldn't even look down your thing because it was all deer. You have to run down scaring all the deer away and then try to shoot the line real quick because they just know the chainsaw noise.
Really?
Yeah.
And were they, so are they eating the...
They knew someone was knocking down cedars or whatever. And they were just, it's like a siren song, man. It's like deer, the sound of a deer feeder motor in Texas. Yeah, chainsaw in northern Michigan, man.
It's good to know.
You were talking about the last of the breed.
The rare breed.
The rare breed.
Yep.
My brother works at this research facility where they're doing a they're working on a project or were working on a project where they're trying to breed Wagyu and limousine cattle. Mm-hmm. So limousine, the carcass attribute would be like it's this huge animal, okay, but very lean. And Wagyu is a small squat animal with very high fat content. So they're trying to do this thing. You breed the two and make a giant high fat content, like to make Wagyu, which is where you get Kobe beef, to get Wagyu from a large animal. And they would, every year, the people that were working on this project would do these T-bone tests, where they would be in a lab and they got all these little grill tables set up, and they grill T-bones to a certain temperature on a electric grill, and then do a thing called a Warner-Bruntler shear force test, where they just punch three holes in the T-bone and see how tender it is, and just discard them. And you'd go to my brother's house when they were doing that, and his, it was like bars of gold stacked up in his fridge, man. He'd just bring all those freaking T-bones home.
With holes punched in.
Three holes.
So whenever you open one up, it'd have like three holes in it.
Could drop an egg in each one.
It punches about a quarter inch hole, man. He always called them his T-bone testers. That was like an annual feed. You think you like the way grizzlies will hammer elk gut piles in the fall? It was like his time of year, man. Is when they were doing the Warner-Bruntler shear force test on Wagyu beef. Land, concluding thoughts?
I'm with Cal. Like, I just, this is such a cool thing that's out there. And I think, you know, getting to have Bart on this podcast and letting people know that there's actual caribou in the lower 48 is a pretty awesome thing. And I think the more people know about it, the more they're going to want to do something about it when we have the opportunity. So I think that's just, I mean, when I think about all the species that have been recovered in the United States and how, like, you know, I haven't been able to be a part of much of that, right? Like, this is still something, like, this and bison are still something we can do, which is pretty darn cool.
They get a lot of attention. I mean, I wrote a whole damn book about them.
you did. And I think, that's a much longer public conversation about that recovery. But with this population, as small as it is, as unique it is, and it's only in a localized area in the lower 48 they could even live, like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think that's cool. Last thing I would say is that one of the things that makes BHA, even though that we are a small organization, is we have badasses that are members and badasses that are in our leadership. And Bart did get that across today, is he spends a ton of time out in the woods. And so he knows the place really well, and he knows what it needs. And so that's who we are as an organization. I think that's pretty darn cool.
Here's my concluding thought. It's two-parter, three-parter. One, I agree with you. Two, I'm just getting old enough where I'm just starting to get, like, I just don't always have a lot of faith in people.
Curmudgeon.
I growing up, there was a friend of mine who told me, a Vietnam veteran, he said, "Stevie, people never change. They say they're gonna, but they never change." And I just, some things I'm like, as much as I'd like to say, it's just hard for me to picture. I hope I'm wrong. It's just hard for me to picture a situation this dire that I wasn't that aware of till today. I mean, I knew a little bit about it. It's just hard for me to picture, like, turning it around.
What kind of person would you want to change? I don't understand what you mean.
It would be something that all of a sudden it would, like, get momentum. But how would it get this bad? And still no one knows about it. At what point did someone go, "Hey, these dodos are getting mighty thin"? Do you know what I mean? Was it one? If there's one caribou, would people come, would NPR go out and do a story? 12's not good enough for you? That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's like, that people are going to all of a sudden be like, "Damn, we need to fix this problem." It's like, if that's going to happen, it seems like it's going to happen pretty quick.
Right. That's frustrating. Yeah. If it was polar bears, or if it was wolves or grizzly bears or something, like, charismatic, like you said earlier.
You need to hire, not you, people need to hire whatever PR agency it is, or maybe there isn't one, but someone should start one that can sell the American public on loving a critter. They did it very effectively with wolves. It was done very effectively with grizzly bears, very effectively with fur seals, which are the farthest thing from endangered. They need to go and be like, "Let's take some of that attention away and put it in a couple places where it really is needed right now."
talk to the people at Coors. I look at my refrigerator and I'm like, okay, 12 beers. Right. 11 beers. I'm like, oh, I better go get more.
Dude, yeah. Dude, a beer can with a beer can with a mountain caribou on it.
Mountain's already there. They're blue caribou. It's cold enough to drink.
That's right.
Stick a caribou on
the caribou
it,
or blue?
Bring the sexy back to caribou, right?
Come on, Pete. Step up if you're listening.
Was that part one of my thing? I had a three-parter.
Two,
oh,
right?
Part one was I agree with Lan. Part two is I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
How did I not, like I like try to stay hip to this stuff. I didn't know. So I'm a little bit mad at myself. Part three, this lion hunting we were talking about. I am pretty, I've chased a couple lions down in dry ground, not on the snow. I'd be real eager to go out and look around, chase lion tracks in the snow with you.
Come on over.
What time of year you like to hit it?
December 15th, we start in Idaho.
How long does it run?
We can kill cats until about Valentine's Day, mid-February, and then we chase until March 31st. And then we go to Montana until April 15th, usually.
But what part of the state do you hunt? You're hunting the panhandle?
Panhandle, yep.
Yeah.
Up north.
And you're hunting lions that are mostly eating whitetails?
Mostly whitetails. Some elk killers also.
You know, elk fat and lion.
Yeah, yeah. The big ones, you know, they get big when they start eating elk.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, it's so much food. They don't have to hunt as hard. They can stay put and just sit around and eat and get big.
Yeah.
But
you eat a lot of lion meat?
Yeah.
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 I've had a number of them.
It's good.
A lot of the lions in kind of the caribou potential area, though?
Well, like I said, early in the season, we try to target those lions up in the caribou recovery area, and then you just get snowed out, and it just gets too hard to get up there. You know, you're talking about 8-10 feet of snow up there, and the lions find little pockets of habitat that they can live in. They don't travel much. It's hard to cut tracks.
Oh, I see. Because they're just kind of holed up somewhere. Yeah.
But early in the season, we catch a lot of big toms coming out of that high country.
They kind of migrate seasonally.
Yeah, they move around. You know, not all of them, but
what's a big tom?
You know, 150 pound cat is a big cat.
Yeah,
anything over that is really a nice one.
Everybody talks about 175 pound, 200 pound lions. I was talking to a biologist in Oregon, and throughout his career, he'd worked up 360 some lions. That's a size. Like, I don't care how hard you hunt lions, it's hard to get to handle 360 of them. Okay. Because he ran the Predator program in Oregon. He worked up 360-some and weighed them. Okay, worked them up like scientific scales. I think the biggest one he had was 164.
Yeah. Yeah, lions.
And that's hundreds.
Like bears, you know, it's people get exaggerated weights.
You never run into somebody who's like, I saw a lion, little female.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, big old Tom.
That's right.
Big old Tom come around the corner.
Everyone's
it's like, oh,
huge.
So you're good with lions, dude. Not only did you know it was big, you gendered that
thing right.
In the dark. Big old Tom come
no
around the corner.
No female quota up there, though, so you can take any cat, right?
Yeah, we don't really pick on the females too much just because we're guiding up there. We don't want to put ourselves out of business. So we try to take toms. There are hunters that kill females out of there, though.
Do you guys tree females or pull the dogs off when it's a female?
If there's young, we'll pull the dogs, but we tree them. It's good for the dogs. We maybe kill 25% of the cats that we tree. We have a lot of clients that just like to go out and take pictures and do that kind of stuff, and a lot of hunters, you know, want to come out and just see a cat or hunt for a week, and we might tree three or four before they find one that they want.
It's probably good for the females that you tree them because it wises them up.
Sure. Yeah, it wises them up.
They're less likely to climb a tree when they hear a dog bark and probably want to keep running.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I think they might be more likely. I think they might.
Really?
Well, if you let them go.
Oh, yeah. No, I got you. So maybe it doesn't wise them up. They're like, the thing to do is climb a tree.
Right. Well, maybe, yeah. Just get up a tree and we're going to get your picture taken and you're going to get harassed for a little bit by the dogs. But
you're right. You're right. It doesn't wise them up. That's a good point. All right. Meat Eater Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.